Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 7th of December. We welcome you to the program, and we are very happy that you are with us. We always welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org is the secret to that. Panel at WAMC.org, and write to us. We get far more letters than we have time to read, but we get to as many as we can. We do curate them to make sure, you know, we're not duplicating and all that kind of thing. But we do get to quite a few. So we hope that you will write in if you have an issue that you would like to discuss or a question you'd like to ask. We welcome you to do so. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Big Joe. How are you?
I'm well.
I'm fine.
You. Yeah. Yeah. I'm the same.
You know, the same. Yeah. This whole thing can get a little tiresome, right?
It can.
We know that. And, you know, but on the other hand, you don't really have any choice. You can't be stupid like Rudy Giuliani was stupid and, you know, goes around and infects all kinds of people. And CNN has been playing those potential infections again and again and again all weekend long with him kissing people, hugging people, putting his arm around people. It's really quite something. And so, you know, it is interesting that the president got it and Giuliani got it. I'm going to stop right there.
Probably best. All right. We also we will have Libby on in a second. We're working on getting a workaround. She was the technology we were using initially was not working. Libby, are you with us?
Yes.
Well, thank God. There is.
There is a God.
Know. We were worried. We didn't know if we were going to have you or not. So that's great. Libby Post is with us. She is a political consultant, a lobbyist, and has been a panel member here for since this panel's inception. And we are always thrilled to have her. Good morning, Libby. And again, glad you are with us.
Thank you so much.
We go to UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, who is with us. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Excellent. Good to hear. And we also welcome Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Okay. Yeah, you know,
this can be expected.
Yeah, it was funny because when Alan said, you know, this all can be a lot, and I knew he was meaning the pandemic, but it's just like life, right? I mean, it's just like just that whole thing can be like putting one foot in front of the other lately seems to be difficult and
fraught.
Yeah, fraught. Exactly. Very, very good way of putting it. So, So let's talk about what's going on here, and we'll look a little bit at Georgia and then move on. Alan mentioned the Giuliani story. Of course, Rudolph Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, who is doing the main fighting, such as it is, of the election fraud charges that are being leveled. And that was the story yesterday. And then the story, of course, this morning is that he has been hospitalized as a result of his coronavirus. So COVID. So that is the that is where we are now. But meanwhile, in Georgia, the president was there over the weekend, and the president spent the weekend saying that they ought to overturn the election. And so now top Georgia Republicans are criticizing the president for spreading falsehoods and misinformation about the election, warning that his comments could make it harder for the GOP to win its upcoming Senate races, and arguing that his continued attacks on the process put local officials in danger. On Sunday night, Governor Brian Kemp, Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan issued a joint statement in response to a call for a special session of the legislature to overturn President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state, saying that doing this in order to select a separate slate of presidential electors is not an option that is allowed under state or federal law. The criticism comes one day after Trump headlined a two-hour rally in the state The event was designed to whip up support for Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, who are locked in a tight January 5th runoff race with their respective Democratic challengers. But instead, President Trump railed against Governor Kemp, the news media, and Democrats, basically suggesting that the election was plagued with widespread fraud and falsely claiming that he had defeated Joe Biden. During an interview earlier on Sunday on CNN, Duncan said Trump was fanning the flames of misinformation and called the president's false claims, quote unquote, concerning. He also criticized the president for suggesting that the election had been, quote unquote, stolen from him, and warned that his statements could keep Republican voters from the polls in January. Alan, I think, you know, if you rolled back the tape on Friday, we had pretty much predicted this would be the case. That is what the president did. And now everyone's just dealing with it, right?
Well, that's true. One of the more disturbing things, which has not made the news big this morning, I read it somewhere in the middle of the night. Justice Alito, remember him?
Yes.
On the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. has given them an extra day and taken somewhat seriously the idea that that voting by mail is forbidden under the U.S. Constitution. Alito, the originalist, Alito, the patriot, Alito, in my mind, I'm sorry, I know this is strong. No, I'll change it from what I was going to say to foolish. Foolish. You know. When you say okay, you say it with some relief.
Yeah.
Because
you knew
where I was going.
Well, that's okay. I think either would have been fine. But so the U.S. Supreme Court has moved up the deadline and in a congressman's bid to upend the Pennsylvania election results. This is the race of an appeal from U.S. Representative Mike Kelly and the state's. So it's now they will respond to an appeal from Representative Kelly by Tuesday, the same day that the states are required to lock in delegates for the Electoral College. So that, of course, is that concern, right?
Right, right. And it's very concerning to me because we've always known that Trump has some aces up his sleeve, and being the cheater he is, who knows when he'll deal from the bottom of that deck. So I don't like it. I don't like the fact that, it's a 6-3 majority on that court. We'll have to see now whether or not some of these people are willing to go on with it. You know, they are just human beings, but the question here is what kind of human beings these justices are. So the days of Justice Douglas and all the great names have been diminished. I mean, I have to tell you, I think John Roberts is making a name for himself here. But this is very, very scary as far as I'm concerned, and I don't think it should be ignored.
You know, you're right, though. It was. I read about this story yesterday because I follow my hometown newspaper of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they had it. And I actually circled it because I didn't know if we were going to get to it or not. But there was a question I had for Sarah, because Sarah, I had no idea. And this is I'm sidestepping it a little bit of what we're talking about here. But the paper says that Associate Justice Samuel Alito, who oversees emergency matters arising out of Pennsylvania for the court, had given state election administrators until Wednesday to file their response. I was fascinated that the justices are assigned states.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And so
I did know it. What they do is each of the justices has an area which they're responsible for immediate appeals, and then it goes to a larger group.
That's interesting. Okay, so go ahead. Yeah.
No, I knew that there was an internal docketing structure, but I didn't know that he was assigned to Pennsylvania. So, you know, because usually that information, I don't know whether or not that information is typically made public. A lot of courts have those sort of internal docketing structures, but people don't usually know when they file something what the sorting hat looks like.
Well, I guess I asked the question because if it had been Justice Sotomayor, given that it could be random, then would this have been taken place of the deadline being moved? And I guess we don't know the answer to
right.
that.
Right.
Interesting question.
That's yeah. an important question.
Yeah. So, and what is a day?
Yeah, but
go ahead, Libby.
The other question about this, saying that that mail-in ballots might be unconstitutional will invalidate every election since the use of absentee and mail-in ballots. I mean, you know, let's see, did Mitch McConnell win because of mail-in ballots, or any of the other Republicans in the Senate, did they win because of mail-in ballots? They might have. And if we're going to throw them all out, then we have to throw all of them out, too. So it's a bit of an overreach, that's for sure.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, we have so many officials, local officials and judges that are writing pretty scathing opinions of the yeah. lack of evidence of any fraud or malfeasance. So, like, it's unusual for those courts to use that certain sort of language, even at the lower court level. Highly unusual. The strength of the language that's being used, like, this is a fantasy. That's not language that's usually deployed in good faith cases. And a lot of lawyers are we're talking about a lot of things, but whether or not there are actually sanctions that can be levied against Trump's attorneys because the allegations were made in bad faith, it's just the conversation in the legal landscape is less nervous, I think, Alan, but because of what we're hearing principled Republican appointed and Republican state and local judicial and executive officials say at the lower stages of these cases. So he may be granting, you know, extending a deadline for an appeal so that the Trump administration feels like that they've been able to avail themselves of every opportunity. But I really don't want to be proven wrong on this, but I have a very hard time believing that the Supreme Court would feel differently than those lower courts in reviewing the exact same evidence. They can't look at anything new.
So. Well, there are a couple of things. One, if I may, one, you better believe that those scathing lower court decisions are put that way precisely because those judges know that this is going to go to the Supreme Court. And they want to give them as little wiggle room as possible. Secondly, we really don't know to this minute whether when Trump said he wanted Barrett on the court because he needed a friend during the election cycle, whether they take that seriously and whether they will be, what's the correct word, prostitutional in voting, 5-4, because Roberts will never join them on this. on this, because Roberts understands what this would make the court look like. But that's, you know, it is clear to me that they wrote those decisions earlier, the earlier decisions, just because they knew they were going to be read by that court.
So, I mean, we can say that, but it is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, that it's even taken seriously where the governor of Georgia, a Republican, is getting a call from the president of the United States and being pressured to overturn the victory of Joe Biden, asking the governor to order also an audit of absentee ballot signatures, as well as calling a special session of the legislature to overturn it. I realize, of course, that you can ask for anything you want, I guess, but it's the fact that it's coming from the president and the governor has to take it seriously. Now, they aren't taking it seriously, but I don't know. What do you do with that?
Well, the governor has made it clear that he has asked for these audits in the past.
Yes.
He didn't get them, but he's asked for them. Look, this is the end of any Republican's career who goes against this president. That we know. And, you know, look, you just have to look no further than what people are saying, what the pollsters are telling us, that the rank-and-file Republicans in this country are feeling. They like Trump. They don't like anybody who goes against Trump. And so, you know, my feeling is that that St. Peter is looking favorably on the governor of Georgia and so many of these other Republicans who have the guts to do what's right.
So meanwhile, you have Senator Loeffler, who was in a debate last night with Reverend Warnock, and Jennifer Burns. It is fascinating because she is in this debate basically saying, look, the president won. I may be working with the president in the upcoming administration, and back to, for want of a better term, the fantasy land that many Republicans are living in the current moment. And so does that help someone like Reverend Warnock when you are talking about, you know, things like reality?
I think it helps Senator Warnock in the sense that it encourages people that Stacey Abrams is also pushing to get out and vote, because they are seeing, you know, they're hearing and seeing how desperate and dire the situation is for them if Loeffler is elected. So, and Stacey Abrams is playing a really powerful role in what's going on in Georgia. So, you know, I absolutely think it helps in that sense. But Loeffler is, troublesome.
That was very nice, by the way. That was very nice. We only have about 30 seconds, so if you want to continue on the other side of the break, we can do that too.
Yeah, I just think, you know, she is trying to stir up the base for the QAnon fans. I think she is trying to hide her wealth, which is out of touch with many of the people who are living in Georgia. And I think Warnock is doing a good job of bringing that all out.
So I'll hold you there. We'll come back. We'll discuss this some more. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson making up the group this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So we've been talking about the fact that the president spent a good deal of Saturday continuing the rant that he released on video last week, and basically, as the Washington Post put it, regurgitating a litany of baseless accusations of election fraud. So now he continues the fight, and continues not to be doing anything else other than apparently stewing about the election. So the Washington Post reports, even as Trump has been consumed with his waning political fortunes in a desperate attempt to retain power, his administration has accelerated efforts to lock in last-minute policy gains and staffing assignments that it hopes will help cement the president's legacy and live on past January 20th, when President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in. For example, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services adopted a longer and more difficult citizenship test that critics said could further curb legal immigration. The Pentagon named 11 new members, including a pair of prominent former Trump campaign aides, to a Defense Department Business Advisory Board. And the president signed an executive order drafted by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy aimed at protecting civil liberties and the use of artificial intelligence by the federal government. So you look ahead at the final 6 weeks of Trump's presidency. The administration has no plans to wind down its efforts to remake federal policies and even the government bureaucracy itself, according to aides, despite the pending handoff to the incoming Democratic administration. The whirlwind of activities has bucked tradition of past presidents who have deferred on major policy actions during the lame duck period. And in some cases, the moves could make it procedurally or politically challenging for Biden to fulfill campaign pledges to unwind the Trump team's actions. Alan, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about just this lame duck period and traditionally what it has been and why this, what we're seeing is somewhat unusual.
Well, we do know that Trump had, 72 million people voting for him. And I've been trying to figure out what's on his mind. I can't, to be honest. I mean, I think his approach is so crazy, nuts, meshuggah, that I can't figure out what kind of a human being would have this lack of responsibility and, frankly, patriotism towards the country. I can't figure it out. But if I had to take a guess, it would be that in order to keep that 70 million or 72 million intact, he has to continue to act the way that he is now and to rail against the others. And at the same time, he has to keep his major contributors happy. And that's what he's doing with all of this nonsense. He'll do whatever he can to mess up the ship of state. And he will continue to do that because clearly that is where he thinks his political advantages lie.
Libby?
So my question is this. He's doing most of this by regulation and executive order. I mean, nothing legislative is being done because the House wouldn't pass anything. How much of this can Biden simply overturn with his own set of regulations and executive orders? I understand if they do the oil leases between now and January 20th, they may be hard to break if there's actually ink on paper and a signature. But what about the other things that he's doing, like the immigration stuff, like the citizenship test? I mean, aren't these things that he's done by executive fiat, can't they be overturned by a new president?
Yes. And in fact, Biden has already said he's going to.
Right. He's going to have a stack of executive orders on his desk that will probably be taller than he is when he's standing up because of everything so heinous that Trump has done. So, you know, I understand why. I understand the legacy issue for Trump, but I don't think it's going to be there when push comes to shove. I think Biden will overturn almost everything that he's done.
But it is being made harder. I mean, they're doing this to make it harder and for it to take more time.
He's doing it to waste time, to build his own base in terms of, look what those horrible Democrats are doing. You see, they really hate Americans. But there were 80 million Americans who voted for Joe Biden. And there are many, many more coming onto the election rolls as kids get older. And groups like Stacey Abrams doing a great job in registering people to vote, that I think the voice of America will be one of, diversity, plurality, and inclusion, rather than this very narrow scope of who is really an American, which is white men, basically.
So two steps
forward. Angry white men.
Two steps forward, two steps back, two steps forward, two steps back. So, Sarah, it seems like we have seen in the last 4 years the Trump administration do everything it can, both in legislation as well as executive order, to turn back the Obama legacy. Now it'll be up to, with seeing what we're talking about right now, is Biden returning things to either the way they were or to improve in some way, shape, or form? Does it always have to be this way of, instead of moving forward, you just two steps forward, two steps back?
It's really aggravating, for sure. And we actually hear from the incoming administration a little bit of waffling around, it's going to be tough. There's a lot that he did in immigration. It's going to be a lot to undo. It's an opportunity. You know, it's not like Trump took measured steps when he came in office. One of the first things he did was try to eliminate DACA, just eliminate it straight up. And, you know, it's, what this signals is that the long-term battle ahead, the battle for the soul of this country, which we thought we're sort of fighting in November, it's not going to be over for a very, very long time. One of the questions that they changed, one of the more controversial questions that they changed on the citizenship test, is who does a U.S. senator represent? And the answer, the correct answer used to be all people of the state. On the new test, it's citizens in the state, right? That's a normative claim. That's saying immigrants, you're not welcome. You know, who is a citizen? Who is a person, right? That's the Roe versus Wade challenge. What does it mean? What is basic things that we thought that we had a shared understanding of? Those are the normative erosions that he's doing, that he's done his whole presidency and is going to be doing in the days leading up. So I think it's less about, you know, two steps forward, two steps back. It's like 8,000 steps back.
Yes.
And now what?
You're right. No, absolutely. I want to talk to you on the other side of the break when we come back. I want to get to Jennifer on this particular topic and then come back to you because over the weekend, the judge ordered that the government fully reinstate DACA, and I would like to talk to you about that. But Jennifer, in this overall issue of the changes and what can be undone and what can be redone, your thoughts on that?
I think some of it can be redone, but I do agree with Libby and Sarah on this in the sense that it is it's a time suck. It's requiring people that are going to be in these positions under Biden to spend incredible amounts of time on kind of dismantling or correcting rather than looking forward, unless if they can do both, really address what Trump administration has put into place, but also do it in a way that's very forward-thinking that protects it for many years. The other thing I think that's important here is to look at that Senate and keep watching it in Georgia, because we have to remember that the Republicans in Georgia that Trump is attacking, right, are going to definitely have to figure out what to do with their party in the GOP. And Governor Kemp is going to be up for election in 2020, or re-election, or running for election, right? So when this happens, Georgia is going to shift depending on if Loeffler wins or if Perdue wins. And we have to think futuristically about how Biden's team is going to try to address what Trump's putting into place, but also how the Senate might change or might not, not just in this election, but as the governors and local officials in Georgia in the next 4 years might change.
So let's pause there. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We have listener letters. And as I said, I want to talk about DACA and the decision over the weekend. We will get to all of that and your letters. Panel at WAMC.org right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson making up the group this morning. So we... right before we went to break, we were talking about DACA and the fact that there was major action over the weekend. Judge ordering the government to fully reinstate the DACA program. Up to 300,000 additional undocumented immigrants could be allowed to apply for protection from deportation under the new court ruling. President Trump had sought to cancel the program. The federal judge on Friday ordered the Trump administration to fully restore the Obama-era program designed to shield young undocumented immigrants from deportation, dealing what could be a final blow to President Trump's long-fought effort to end the protections. Sarah, as promised, let me go to you on this and say, do you look at this as a final blow?
Yes and no. There are lots of ways that the Trump administration can still try to interfere with DACA. It's possible that this can go the DACA fight can go back up to the Supreme Court. Sorry, my dog. and that would be a different court because, of course, instead of Ginsburg, we have Amy Coney Barrett, and Amy Coney Barrett has signaled in the past restrictionist views about immigrants. And so, you know, I give up. trying to predict what will happen as long as he has any power whatsoever. But what I will say is that it's extraordinary. We've been operating under a very limited DACA program for a very long time, and this reinstates it for new applicants, not just, so you'll remember, the prior reinstatement was a partial reinstatement because the Supreme Court basically told the Trump administration that they rescinded it incorrectly, that they didn't follow the rules when they rescinded it. This particular ruling is different. It says that the person that Chad Wolf acted outside of his scope of authority in his memo. So the memo is invalid, which reinstates the program, which means that new applicants can apply, which has been frozen for a long time. It was that no one could apply. And then it was that you can only submit renewals and that they would only be valid for a shortened period of time. And now it's completely restored back to its original, well, not its original, right? The Supreme Court or the Fifth Circuit struck down another part of this back under the Obama administration. But long story short, there's still a chance for Trump to mess with DACA. And that's why it's a really problematic the Obama administration, rather than continuing to push on Congress and the various gangs of however many numbers to really make lasting change in immigration law and policy, that they settled for executive action. Because this is what happens. And this is the two steps forward, two steps back in immigration, that it just enrages every practicing immigration lawyer and professor in the country. Because if every 5 days something changes, and under this administration, it's way more often than that. And so, you know, I'm not going to predict what happens next, but I will tell you that there's a groundswell of support for whatever happens next in support of DACA. Because this, you'll remember, was a grassroots movement of young people, of undocumented folks themselves, and they're not giving up anytime soon.
Can you address, before we broaden it out to everybody else, but can you address the timing of the decision from the court? I assume that is on purpose. You don't do it before the election. You do it after. You do it on a Friday. You do it. I don't know. Am I making that up, or is there a plan there?
You mean the timing of the decision from the more recent decision from the court?
Yes, this latest decision.
So I haven't looked at the docketing, and I haven't seen anybody write up an analysis of that. It may be that the case was kicking around so long that their internal deadlines were triggered in terms of when they courts really. I haven't seen a court time a ruling around political considerations. I'll just say it that way.
Okay. Well, that was my question. So that answers that. Okay. Alan, your thoughts?
Well, we have how many days to go before the inauguration? Something like 40 something. Is that right?
40, yep. Yeah.
It's hopefully. Ordinarily you would think that a lower court decision would end up in the Supreme Court if they thought that they were right, especially with this court. Yes, Sarah? Don't you think?
What do you mean?
In other words, if it's a lower court decision, sooner or later the Trump people would appeal it to the Supreme Court where they will have, a better ear.
Right.
So, with 40 days to go... Yeah, with 40 days to go, that's not likely to really happen, although it could. He is it just adds to the legend of Trump as a stinker, that he would sink all these deserving, wonderful young people, many of whom haven't been in another country ever, or if they have, it was at birth, and now, his attempts to take it out on them and by getting them back there. It's just and depriving them of any kind of resources. Please.
It's really a challenge for the Biden administration still, too, though, right? Like the court, it's not like Trump leaves office and this lawsuit disappears, right? They can still, the government can still appeal. And so, like, it's a challenge for the Biden administration because of all the rulings that have issued so far, right? He's bound by the same rulings in terms of how to administratively change the DACA program in any way, right? He's bound by the same Supreme Court opinion. He's also bound by the opinion that restricts, you know, sort of puts constrictions around Chad Wolf's authority, right? Anybody, that means Chad's successor is bound by the same problem. So I read a Vox article that had an interesting analysis of, like, you know, if the Republicans retain control of the Senate and Biden's appointments are all tied up and remain acting secretaries of whatever, right? Because they haven't finished going through the process, if the Republicans are otherwise obstruct, right, appointments, then the Biden administration arguably, because of some of these rulings, may be sort of tied up in terms of what they can do. So they're trying to impact the Biden administration before it even gets off the ground.
But on the other hand, you don't really think that Joe Biden is going to adopt this nasty approach to
no, no, no. But he could. But what if he wanted to improve it? Say, right? So he would be bound by the same issue. So it really speaks to why Congress needs to act. It's Congress who's in charge of immigration. Congress writes the Immigration and Nationality Act. Congress can amend it. And so, again, you know, it speaks to the importance of this Georgia election. We need not just comprehensive immigration reform. We need bold, progressive immigration overhaul, period.
Jennifer, anything you'd like to add to that?
You know, what struck me as Sarah was talking about this is how we miss that this is a federal attack on, for lack of better words, brown people. This is an attack on Latino children in America. And I think that gets lost in this discussion because they're born in America, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. And by not putting it in that kind of framework, we are missing a huge piece of this conversation, because it is not as if Trump is saying this or his administration is doing this in other aspects in such a verbal way. And it also really masks how he is able to get a base of Latino supporters while at the same time attacking them.
We have just about a minute to go here before we go over to a break. So I'm going to just go through a couple of the letters, and then when we come back, we'll continue, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. Greg writes, on Saturday, we had thousands standing without masks, shoulder to shoulder from noon to 9 p.m. in Georgia. I would have parked state trooper vehicles and fire trucks all over the tarmac and washed the keys for the afternoon. I would have dispersed the crowd before it assembled. Why will no one tell this guy to stop murdering people? Will he be allowed to continue this after he's no longer in office? I will vote for the first person that stands up to him and refuses to allow those rallies. We go to Levi, who says, longtime listener, love the show. At what point can sedition enter the lexicon? The president is publicly working to weaken our form of government. I would reference you back to Malcolm Nance's Thursday appearance, in which he talked about treason and sedition at great length. Unless there is anyone on the panel who would like to weigh in on that. Richard says, in Saturday's speech to his adoring fans, President Trump pronounced that had election officials in Georgia known what they were doing, they would have assured Trump of victory. I take that as Trump saying that election officials in Georgia are incompetent because they don't know how to rig and throw an election. These Georgian officials should go on a fact-finding trip to Russia so that they can learn how to properly hold a rigged election that will assure victory for Trump and the Republicans. We'll pause there. We'll continue with more letters on the other side of our break. We also will go on to more topics. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll take a break, get news from Ray Graff, and more right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson making up the group. Panel at WAMC.org is where you can send your letters to us. Quick programming note, Governor Andrew Cuomo will be giving an update on the state's response to the pandemic. That happening at 11 o'clock this morning, about a half hour earlier than usual. So the governor will be speaking at 11. So we will be doing this and then going to the congressional corner and then hitting the governor, meaning going to the governor at we'll do that at 11 o'clock this morning. So that is our plan ahead. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Just go to a few of these. Jim would like Sarah to define progressive immigration reform. What does that look like?
Oh, there are lots of really good ideas. One involves some measure of amnesty for people who have been here for a long time. You know, the last one of the big amnesty programs that we had in this country was under Ronald Reagan. I encourage everyone to go back and watch footage of past Republican presidents with whom I largely disagree on most things talking about immigration, because it's a reminder, a good reminder of how to have more honest conversations about what immigration means and has meant to America from the beginning of our nation's founding. So, you know, I'm not afraid of saying the word amnesty. I don't think a lot of Republicans should be either. There are the American Immigration Council, and then in New York, the Immigration Advocates Response Collaborative have posted suggestions for what more progressive, comprehensive immigration reform would look like. And I don't even want to say progressive. It's just actually morally justified immigration reform. Like, let's get out of this damaging rhetoric of the last 4 years, and really, I mean, the last several decades. And Jennifer's spot on. It has a lot to do with the changing demographics, the changing skin tone of the people who are immigrating to our country. And it's not just here. It's happening in Europe as well. I know at some point we'll probably return to conversations about Brexit and whatever happens next with all of that. But it means a lot of things, but really what it means is going back to our moral center of welcoming the stranger and becoming embracing our identity as a nation of immigrants.
Anybody else on that?
Well, I think one thing I'd like to add to this is I want to correct myself a little bit, because initially I had said DACA was applied to people born into America, in America, and it does not. So I misspoke on that part. But I was thinking also of this attack on brown children brought to America and how we're watching it unfold really behind the scenes and then getting these reports later of what's going on to children at the border, because that is also being forgotten about by many people, right? The children that are being separated from their parents, it's still happening. And in many cases, don't know where the parents are, can't reconnect the children with them. I think there's more, and I agree totally with Sarah about how we need to reform and look at really protecting DACA, but also think about this in that moral framework of these are children, and they are the next generation, and they should be respected and protected. And our government has the power to do that, not only in America, but in many other countries. And it is critical that Democrats included with these Republicans get their act together. I'm saying that nicely, because this is creating more hatred, more bigotry, and real personal lifelong harm to people. It should be, it's, in my opinion, it's criminal.
Mm. Libby?
And the other part of this that I don't think people really look at in the long term is demonizing the people that we are demonizing, or not us personally, but that this administration is demonizing, especially what happened at the border, is what will foment homegrown terrorism against the United States in the long term. You know, you look at what we did in Afghanistan in the 80s, and that sparked bin Laden and everything else that he did. And, you know, when you treat people, when you treat people based on their skin, based on their religion, based on whatever, poorly, and these people are already poor and desperate, you know, like the folks that follow Trump, they will, those within those communities who are demagogues will be able to rally their own troops, and we will end up being a target. And we have to understand that historically this has happened time and time again, and we just don't get it. And so it behooves us and it benefits us to go back to those biblical roots that Sarah was talking about and welcome the stranger. Because welcoming the stranger is what we've been told to do on so many different levels. And it is not bad for our country. It is not bad for our neighborhoods or our families. It is one of those things. It's about compassion and kindness, which has been lost in the last 4 years and has not been shown at all out of this administration. And I think is what a lot of people are looking for when they see Joe Biden be inaugurated. You know, I'm looking forward to that speech with the themes of kindness and compassion and inclusion. And it's, we need to get back to those roots of what America really is, because Alan knows this and I know this. And I bet you everybody else on this call knows this. We didn't, we were brought here. Our parents, our grandparents, our great grandparents, they were brought here. You know, whether on slave ships, which some of us were brought here on slave ships, or our grandparents and great-grandparents decided to emigrate here. One way or the other, we were all the other at some point. And it's time for us to recognize that this country was built on the backs of the other, and we can no longer afford to say you're no longer welcome.
Alan?
Well, you know, one of our proudest possessions, which somebody bought for us, I think my kids did, is manifest for the ship that brought my grandparents, my grandmother here.
Right.
And it's up on the wall, and we are that, and Libby is exactly right. But what really gets me is that half this country, let me go back. My wife, Roselle, and Pete Seeger were sitting at our dining room table one night, and they had a discussion about human beings. Are they good? are they made up of good or bad? And Rosella and Pete agreed that it was, you know, sort of half and half, maybe a little bit more towards the not so good than the good. The point being that 70 million people voted for Donald Trump, knowing full well what his appeals were on the to the right and to the anti-immigrant and to the anti-other, which he has built his entire political mess on. You know, it is so clear that those 72 million people are that part which Pete and Roselle were talking about, which is not a very good self-image of who and what we should be, the kind of self-image that Libby was just so wonderfully talking about.
You know, sir, I was interested about what you were saying and about going back and looking at how this used to be discussed. When did it start to change? When did we start to see the change? And that it, and because it seems like a lot of our that our demons have been freed and I guess there's a narrative that says that 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 people like Donald Trump, but not solely Trump, but people like Donald Trump have allowed these feelings to go forward and has unleashed this, which would indicate that it was always there. So I'm wondering of how much of it was. Were they in true belief of what they were saying at that time, and at what point did it start to erode?
So, several of my colleagues have written brilliant law review articles and books about this, and I would highly strongly.
Oh, cool! Could you summarize them in 30 seconds? Thank you.
Yes, one great book is a book called "Migrating to Prison." That's a great book. There's another. Yeah, there. Maybe I could do like a reading list.
Yeah, there you go. I like that.
For people who don't have the time to read all of that. You know, in 1996, the IRA, it's called the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. I mean, just think of the title, Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996 passed. Subsequent to that, we had 9/11. That resulted in a lot of militarization at the border and restrictionist practices.
Sure.
It's not that long ago, though, that the border was patrolled literally by young men on horseback, the entire border. There was no wall. It was just land and a couple of guys on some horses. And it's really interesting to read about that history of the early 20th century border zone, because you realize how quickly and how aggressively we've criminalized immigration and militarized the border. And it's been, I guess I would say, on hyperspeed in the last three decades. Mm-hmm. And fueled by this rhetoric. So when you talk about progressive immigration policies, they're really not that progressive. It's restoring asylum, which was, you know, post-World War II, well-settled international law. The Trump administration has blown that up. That's one of the most defensive things that they've done, right? We represent three asylum seekers and my students right now who are living in refugee camps in Matamoros, waiting to enter the country lawfully under because of the policies that the Trump administration has put into place. Families who have been fleeing violence, who have been individually targeted by government actors or actors that the government is unable or unwilling to control. That, and we have thousands of immigrants stuck in civil immigration detention who have done nothing wrong. Immigration violations are a civil violation. We've criminalized the whole thing. So decriminalizing immigration, ending civil detention, ending the carceral punishment. I have a broader theory about that more generally in progressive politics. But, you know, decarceration and decriminalization and demilitarization of the entire immigration system. And that's a lot. When you look at it, it's a daunting task. Unless we have good people in leadership speaking in defense of immigrants and, you know, the good old days of the rule of international law.
So let's move on to some other topics, and then we'll go ahead.
If I could, let me.
I just need you on the mic, Alan.
Oh, you are so right. It's always better when you do that.
Yes.
Okay, so we heard from Tom in Stockbridge, who said, regarding Trump's team action, Obama, in the last 3 weeks before Obama's term, banned oil drilling off the Atlantic coast, established new environmental monuments, protected funding for Planned Parenthood clinics, ordered the transfer of detainees from Guantanamo Bay, criticized Israeli settlements, punished Russia for interferon in the recent elections through cyber attacks. Please do some research before sounding so hypocritical. This was gleaned from the Washington Post, Tom says. Why the outrage now and not then? I thought that was a very interesting letter. I thought Obama was right and using his powers for the right things, all of which were mentioned by Tom. And on the other hand, the stuff that Trump is doing is obscene. So it isn't only that people do things at the last minute. It's what they're doing, Tom. You know what I mean?
I bet Tom is saying no, but sure.
Yeah, Tom is not happy. Tom is not happy. Anybody else want?
Never be happy.
But I like the rhetorical nature of it.
Anybody else want to check in on that one?
Libby?
Well, no. I mean, there are some people that will never be happy. But the fact of the matter is, Alan is right. Obama did what he did. Look, Obama did what he did for the right reasons. But he wasn't trying to undermine Trump's administration. He was following through on policy and issues. I mean, the same thing could be said for Trump. But he was following through on policy initiatives that were good for the country, okay? And there wasn't this overreaching. There wasn't anything like, oh, we're going to, you know, change the citizenship test. Obama spoke out against Russia interfering in the election. He secured funding for Planned Parenthood so women would have access to reproductive health care. He did good stuff. He didn't try to undermine the incoming administration, and that's the difference here.
And let's just say for a second, Libby, that he had tried to undermine the incredibly bad things that this administration has stood for. What would be so wrong with that?
Well, there is that. And if he did try to do that, he would have done it in such a nuanced way, it wouldn't make, you know, the New York Post front page. So there you go.
So let's go to another story before we have to break at the bottom of the hour. We've been talking about this a lot on this program and the back and forth. And certainly Alan and I have talked about it a great deal, but that is about Bill Barr. And so the attorney general's future came into doubt after he acknowledged that the Justice Department had not found evidence of widespread voter fraud in the president's election loss. Then the question was, when we were discussing this last week, if the president would fire Barr before the end of the administration, 44 days from today. Now we hear word that Barr is said to be weighing whether to leave before Trump's term ends or before he is fired. So, Alan, what do you think is up with that? Is that a...
Well, we don't know. Right, Joe? We just don't know. The fact of the matter is, Trump's advisors, this we know, told him not to do it. On the other hand, Trump wants him out of there. And Trump is really obsessive when it comes to this kind of stuff. As you know, he fires at will. So one possibility is that they're talking to each other. And what Barr is being told is, go on your own. You won't have to be fired that way. But I don't see what he gains from that, to be perfectly honest with you. So the short answer is, I don't know.
Libby, what do you think?
I think it's fascinating. I mean, you know, here's a man, Barr, who was more than willing to say that we had the imperial president, right? He was, up until the election and then the response. And then they did the research. You know, there were actual facts involved. And he said, no, there wasn't anything widespread enough to overturn the results of the election. And, you know, Trump is so thin-skinned and so insecure in his own power that he immediately has to fire anybody who says, I'm sorry, you're wrong. I mean, he did it with Chris Krebs, right, the guy who was running the administration's cybersecurity program. You know, whether he'll actually fire you know, the attorney general remains to be seen. I think it would be seen as a blight on his legacy, whatever that might be. And who really, I mean, we may not like Barr, but he's a very smart guy. And does Trump really want to get on that side of Barr when Trump is going to be facing all of these legal problems when he leaves office?
And how do we know what Barr knows, right, Libby? We don't know what
right.
Barr knows,
I mean,
and what the FBI knows.
That's we right. All,
we,
they know
we
a
do
lot.
Know, we do, that's right. We do know that Giuliani said he better not do anything bad to me. Because
right.
I have too much
right.
information. He said that.
Right.
So I'm assuming that the same thing is true for Barr.
Yes. Yes. And some other people, I'm sure, in the administration as well.
All right. Go ahead.
All these yahoos are incredibly self-motivated and self-interested. Yes. And Barr has millions and millions of dollars in the bank. And I think he's reading, he's playing a very delicate game because he wants to get out of there with, I don't even think he cares about his reputation. He doesn't want to go to jail. And he doesn't, so he's not going to participate. He's not going to do the things that Trump wants him to do right now in this moment. And he wants to keep his millions and millions. He wants to keep his piles of money. And the stock market doesn't really like volatility, right? A stable democracy changes, you know, undergirds the stability of the financial market. So I think he's just acting in his own self-interest and trying to thread a very dangerous needle.
Well, and couldn't he in his mind, too, be thinking, I've done enough, right? Like, I mean, when you go back to what he came in two years, it was February 2019. And it seems like a decade, but
it really does. I'm shocked that you're saying that. Yes. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Seems a lot longer.
And since he's been there, which hasn't even been, two full years, he has testified. And you remember the testimony over the summer with the Black Lives protest and how he was defending the actions of the president and what was going on there. He put out the Mueller, you can't even call it a Mueller report summary, four pages of black ink of changing all of that. He's encouraged the president and supported him in his reducing the sentences and pardons for people like Roger Stone and others. He's kind of sent out Jeff Rosen, and kind of thrown Jeff Rosen's already in it, but John Durham, who he's now appointed, and John Durham was all wrapped up in the stuff about Barack Obama and like Spygate and all those things. I mean, like, hasn't he done enough? He probably just feels like, meh, I'm going to go sit on my money, did my job, said my last few things about the elections, finding no evidence there, and I'm going to go about my life.
I hope you're right.
I mean, he'll, use the friendships he's made to do some more trading and stock buying and company stuff, and he'll see where it all plays, where the dust settles and how he'll make his next move.
So we have a couple of letters here. I'll read those before we go to break in just a minute. And we go to Audrey, who said, I watched the debate between Warnock and Loeffler on Sunday night. It was an embarrassment. Every time Warnock spoke about Loeffler, he said my opponent or the senator. When Loeffler spoke about Warnock, she said radical liberal Warnock does this or that. It made me furious every time she did it. She was speaking without passion, care, or truth. And she'll be reelected in all likelihood. I wish things were different.
Did I read that she was married to the head of the New York Stock Exchange?
Is that true? I don't know. I don't know offhand, but I'll certainly look it up during the break.
I think so.
I know she has a lot of money. I didn't know where that came from. But Dave says the Georgia voting manager, Gabe Sterling, who heroically called out Republicans and Trump for making false fraud claims, said it in an interview, I think, with Rachel Maddow. He still thinks the Republican Party is better than Democrats, whom he thinks will destroy America and wishes Trump had won. Just incredible. And finally, we'll end with Rob, who writes simply 44 days until inauguration. Just remember, folks, that tomorrow it will be 43.
Yeah.
With that, we'll take a break and come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our final go around here, 10:34 on this Monday morning. It is the 7th of December. And Alan, yes, you are correct. Jeffrey Craig Sprecher, Sprecher, I believe that's how that's pronounced. Founder, chairman, and CEO of Intercontinental Exchange, chairman of the New York Stock Exchange.
There you go.
65 years old, born in Madison, Wisconsin. I only tell you that because I have it in front of me. Okay. Let's see. We have some letters. We've got people on
DACA here that I want to get to. David says, aren't DACA recipients people who were born elsewhere and brought in as children? People born here are automatically citizens, correct? Question mark?
Yes, that was my mistake. Correct. I misspoke, and okay. then I corrected myself later and said,
okay.
Yes, you did.
I think the letter came in after that, and okay. So we go then to Desiree, who says, my husband likes to say some people just like to watch the world burn. This is exactly how Trump wants to set up the next administration, to bog them down in administrative needs so it takes forever for them to get things done. Of course, Trump is also petty and spiteful. He's like the teenager that will knock over the table piled with stuff before he leaves the room.
But doesn't that help Biden so much? Because here's Biden, who is obviously a class act. And behaving himself and bringing us back to our regular democratic norms. And the more that Trump acts out, the better that Biden looks, in my opinion. And I think that's why Biden won the election.
Yeah,
but mm-hmm. looks are one thing. Being able, you know, hitting a roadblock in appointing your cabinet and getting transition information that's necessary. In some of the executive orders and laws and things that the Trump administration and his cronies are putting into place is something more, right? I mean, so Biden can look great. He can say great things. But if the law and misinformation is being given to him in this limited transition mm-hmm. package that is going on, it is harming his ability or inhibiting his ability and the people that he's appointing to make positive change for Americans.
Well, you're right, of course. Nevertheless, you know, you got to figure Biden was a United States senator for 40 years, right? He was a vice president of the United States for 8 years. He has a lot of friends and a lot of information. And while you're right that it was despicable that they weren't sharing their information with him, it is also so that if anybody knows where they are and what they're doing, it has to be Joe Biden right now.
All right, let's go to Christopher, who says, Libby, please explain how Bill Barr is a smart guy. I'm fascinated to hear why you think this. Educated, yes. Smart? Question mark?
Well, he wouldn't get... Look, he's been Attorney General of the United States twice. You know, you can, if you would like, you can substitute smart with devious. That would be fine. But the fact of the matter is, you don't get to where those levels with that if you're an idiot. Well, I shouldn't say that because we have an idiot for the president. But, you know, he is an anomaly unto himself. But, you know, did I say he was intelligent? Did I say he was somebody to look up to? Did I say that, you know, he was a Rhodes Scholar? No. I just said he's smart, and he knows what he's doing, and he knows how to interpret the law, and, you know, he sees the president as the imperial presidency, much like Nixon's presidency. He thinks executive power should be unquestioned, and you can't be stupid to get there.
Robert sums up all this by saying Barr can quit now or he can wait until the 20th of January or get fired. Doesn't matter. The Trump stink will stay with him for eternity. Mike writes to us and says, having worked in the Board of Elections, I've seen how absentee/mail-in ballots are counted. Once the signatures have been verified, the ballot is removed for counting and the envelopes are set aside. Once this happens and the ballots are counted, I do not understand how the signatures can be re-verified. Can someone help me on this?
Not me.
Yeah.
What was the question?
They're always talking about verifying the signatures, Libby. The point is that the ballot has been separated from that verified envelope.
Yeah, from the envelope.
So how do you know? How can you possibly go back and do it again?
How do you re-verify it?
I think one of the things they can verify is the barcode that's on. I think there's a barcode on the ballot. I'm not totally sure about this, folks, so don't quote me.
And your state may vary.
Don't quote me. Right, she says right, to 10,000 right. people on the radio.
Right. Oh, I thought it was 400,000 people, Alan.
No, it's 500,000, actually.
Okay. There's a barcode which is unique to every voter.
Only 10,000 care about this. Go ahead.
Right. So there's a barcode unique to every voter so that you can't get more than one ballot from a voter. That's how, at least in New York, people could send in their absentee ballots and also decide to go vote in person if they wanted to change their votes. And then, because it's all based on a unique barcode, and then once the barcode on the absentee would be run, they would see that the person voted in person and they would discard the absentee ballot. So there is a barcode, but you can't check the signatures because you don't sign your absentee ballot. You sign the outside of the envelope that it comes in. You send it back in.
It also makes you a little nervous, doesn't it, Libby, in terms of knowing the one thing that we know about our votes are that they're confidential. And this begins to smack of something else.
Right. Who'd you vote for?
I mean, the my understanding in Georgia was that in most of the cases, well, in all of the cases with mail-in and absentee ballots, that you have a paper trail, and that is what they were going over in each case, even through the machine count and the hand count, was that they had a paper trail, and that was what they said in all of these machines, and that was why the Dominion argument was so readily thrown out of the courts, was because in every case there was a paper trail. And that was what they were going back and looking at. So, as Libby smartly said, that is my belief. Don't quote me on it. Okay, we go to
very smart.
Again, your state may vary. Go check it out. But that is my understanding of it.
You know, that's the thing. That's what goes back to Alito's thing about throwing out absentee ballots or paper ballots or the mail-in ballots. Every state gets to control its own voting process. That's part of the deal. That's part of states' rights and the whole nine yards. And so for him to say, oh, you can't do that, flies in the face of 240 years of electoral process.
Yeah. So we did get word yesterday regarding the timeline for the vaccine. Trump officials are pushing an ambitious vaccine timeline. This all happening as a national surge is underway in the virus. And in California, residents are now facing the strictest restrictions since the beginning of the pandemic. But with that, the Trump administration's top health officials outlined an ambitious timetable on Sunday for distributing the first coronavirus vaccinations to as many as 24 million people by mid-January, even as the accelerating toll of the pandemic filled more hospital beds across the United States and prompted the new shutdown orders in much of California. After criticism from President-elect Joseph Biden that the administration had, quote, no detailed vaccine distribution plan, the chief science advisor of Operation Warp Speed, the Trump administration's vaccine development program, said all residents of long-term care facilities and health workers could receive the first round of vaccinations by mid-January. So that is following the recommendations of the CDC, although it's still questioned as to whether there will be enough initially to accomplish that in full. A vaccine manufactured by Pfizer could be available by the end of the week after anticipated approval by the Food and Drug Administration. And Mr. Azar, Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, was on CNN State of the Union on Sunday and said really within 24 hours of FDA green lighting with authorization, will ship to all of the states and territories that we work with, and within hours they can be vaccinated. But the hopeful comments were met with some skepticism as they played out against an increasingly desperate backdrop with the virus surging across the country and packing hospitals to near capacity with critically ill patients.
Just on Friday, more than 229,000 new cases were reported in the United States.
Hey, Joe, do you remember when everybody was going to be able to get a test who wanted one back in the day?
Right.
Same guys, same liars.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, you have I mean, you. I understand that the approval is expected and will probably come by this week, and if not, the beginning of next week. But still, as of right now, we have a vaccine that is yet to be approved, and there are concerns about the supply line for Pfizer. So you do wonder, but you're hopeful, but you wonder, but it's still very, very questionable as to, well, not questionable, but you have so many people that need it. You have the concerns of people that people are actually going to get it, and then how it rolls out and starts to impact the very, very concerning numbers that we're seeing. Libby?
I wonder, you know, I have to say they're doing a great tap dance. This administration is saying, oh, we've got a plan, we've got this, we've got that. The idea that people are going to start being vaccinated, you know, in a matter of hours is laughable. They haven't even figured out, A, which ones they're going to use, how they're going to pack, if they use Pfizer, how they're going to get all that dry ice that they need, how it's all going to be shipped, but then how those vaccines are going to be stored, because there is a complete lack of high-level, really cold refrigerator storage in these communities that really need this.
Yeah.
If it's the nursing homes and healthcare workers who are going to get this at the beginning, we have to make sure that they have these high capacity, low temperature storage units in order to keep these things. And none of that is in place. I mean, it's a joke. It's an absolute joke. And I'm hoping that Biden's new pick for HHS, Bereka, the AG from California,
yes,
who's a former congressman and who's great on health care, will be able to put something together quickly. And with that'll stand the test of time. Because quickness in something like this doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work.
Jennifer?
Well, I'm thinking about the number of doses. I mean, first, there's the supply line and manufacturing issues that I think the Biden administration is calling out. Not only is it saying, where are these things going, but then how are people actually going to be administered these vaccines? But Pfizer and Moderna both said that they would have, 1 million or 100 million to 3 million dosages. They have 45 million between the two.
Yeah.
The U.S. population is over 300 million. So, I mean, this is such a limited number of vaccines anyway. We have to consider the possibility that between the dry ice issues and other things, many of that 45 million might not be viable when they are received wherever they may be going. So as ambitious and fantastical sounding as this is, it really, like Libby said, is looking more and more like not that great. I'm not feeling like mid-January is going to be the start of this great move that's going to start vaccinating massive amounts of people in America.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath.
Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank everybody for being with us and for talking about these very important issues. Alan, thank you so much.
Thanks for being our leader, Joe.
Jennifer, Libby, and Sarah, thank you. We are going to go to the Congressional Corner next, and then we'll hear from the governor coming up at 11 o'clock. We'll be right back.